So let's do the quiz first and go over that. Okay. I thought it was going to be a gimme, but it wasn't a gimme, was it? Sorry. We covered everything. Anyways. Oh, goodness gracious. It's all... yes, we could. Last name is...
Tobolowsky.
Yes, sorry. As soon as you say it, I recognize it.
Is that weird one?
It's that long, long name one.
Not spelled right.
Great. All right. We'll deal with the rest later. So let's look at this first. Which cell types are primarily used for color vision in the human eye? What was the key I told you? C? Four? Color. Yes, so nobody should miss that one. Is this thing focused? Hopefully. Possibly. Yes, there it is. Somehow. Okay, so that one's good. The two main differences of omatidia and rods and cones, insects and vertebrates. Omatidia, when their light hits it, what does it do? It depolarizes. And what about the rods and cones? Hyperpolarize, which is related to the difference of the dark current and when light gets on it, right? So some people missed this, but then didn't get the dark current part, which is all correlated here. And that's what I was trying to give you some hints there with the multiple choice. The best part that we've kept emphasizing on enhancing visual contrast in the retina was lateral inhibition, both in the insect and in the mammalian system. This one was a little bit interesting. I tried to help out by snail-like structure, just in case we didn't know the name of a cochlea, right? So the different parts of the eye, we should know, what should we know? We should know the utriculus and sacculus. That's the part where those little stones are, like the lobster statocyst, which does what? What do the statocysts do? They detect gravity, right? So, a lot to do with gravity, right? Like position, static position, right? And so that's what those do. Okay, so then what is the other part of the ear? The little semicircular canals, what do? The ones with the loops around it, right? And remember we talked about the fluid that's inside there? Like when the, yeah, so they detect equilibrium sense, right? And then what does the snail-like structure do with that long membrane that kind of wraps around in that snail-like structure? Remember the tympanic membrane? Malleus and Gustapes hits the round window, and, you know, puts up the fluid that moves around through the cochlear, and then basically the transduction goes on that tectorial membrane, and that tectorial membrane is sitting on top of the hair cells inside, remember? So when that vibrates back and forth, what does it do? It bends those hairs, and that it's tonotopically arranged, as we mentioned, low frequency and high frequency, and those nerves come out, and they go into the brainstem, and they keep that tonotopic arrangement. Those are test questions that you get on MCAT type of test. So what does that relate to? Hearing. Yes, we got it. Okay. So hearing, like that snail-like structure. How else to remember this possibly? Think about that big old conch shell that you might see in the movies, you know, where the kids blow on the big shell and boom, you know, make that big sound. Sorry, on there on echo. But anyways, think about that. You know, hearing. Maybe the snail-like structure and hearing will help that in that part. All right, don't say produce sound, please, on the open response question. This one, we kind of went over this a few times, I thought, but that this is really important because this is on your standardized type of test, too, and you might see this picture again. Sensory input coming in, dorsal root ganglion goes into your dorsal horn. These are the connections inside that could go straight down to, say, the motor neurons down here in the ventral horn is where the cell bodies are for your motor neurons. We even did that picture last time on Tuesday for the Renshaw cell, showing where the alpha motor neuron comes off, and then the Renshaw cell's here and then gives feedback back on the alpha motor neuron. So where did we want to highlight anything in here? Right, on the ventral horns, I was kind of referring to these arrows. Some of you might have put this or circled this whole thing, so that's okay. But the question really is, you got to be a little bit careful on this. You know, cell bodies, right? Cell bodies, where are the cell bodies located for motor neurons? Ventral horns. Cell bodies for sensory neurons, in this situation, dorsal root ganglion, right? And interneurons in between here, what's the outside of the butterfly structure? What's out there? Outside the butterfly. White matter, right? And those are the tracks that run up and down the spinal cord. And so inside the butterfly is gray matter. Why do we call that gray matter? It looks gray. No. It's gray matter because this is where synapses are, right? You don't have the insulation. You don't want to insulate between the synapses, right? So this is gray matter where the butterfly is. And outside is the white matter. These are the tracks that run up and down. Why is it white? Because it contains... what wraps around the nerves?
Myelin,
right? So myelination up and down. And you don't want those wires to short out, right? So you have the insulation, just like your electric wires on a lamp, right? You don't want the two wires exposed, the copper wires, they would short out. But while we're on that little topic, it's kind of interesting because if you look at these, you know, tracks that run up and down, actually there was a guy, Solaruka, at Yale University, he actually... study this particular aspect, which is quite interesting, is that the tracks, if you had a myelination, say myelination around, say nerves, and that myelination kind of goes around, you know, the nerves and the neurons that are inside, so let's say that's a neuron, that activity of one neuron could spill out some potassium, right? And what did we learn about the leach system with potassium? Remember that one cell that they repetitively stimulated and then had an electrode inside the glial cell and measured what happened when you repetitively stimulated the Ritzia cell or one of those big neurons? What happened to the glial cell? Action potential, sodium goes in. What comes out? Potassium. What's potassium going to do extracellularly to other cells around it? Your experiment that you did in your lab. Depolarize it. So the idea is in the glial cell in that leech, that was one of the first recordings that actually showed the physiology of the glial cell's function was actually it measures that potassium, detects it, but it actually takes up the potassium and buffers that potassium spilling around the neurons. Solaruka at Yale studied this for many years. He died a number of years back, but he was actually a pioneer in some of these studies with high activity of different neuronal tracks and actually seeing how it could influence neighboring neuronal tracts, even though they weren't stimulated. And what he did that was really cool about that was that he actually showed that had an impact on neighboring cells. And so this word you might hear sometime, and I don't think we covered it when we talked about synapses, it's called ephaptic transmission, E-P-H-A-T-I-C. Ephaptic transmission, where the activity, it's not a regular synapse, but it's activity of one nerve, like spilling out potassium, influencing the other nerve next to it, or neuron next to it. And so this ephaptic transmission has somewhat come back in the literature. You'll find a few papers on it if you wanted to look that up and maybe do an article on it. Remember, tonight is when are your articles due today? Right? Okay, everybody together? You hear that echo? Okay. All right, so you know, try to get those in there. But some really interesting aspects. We just can't cover everything about all this. Now, this one was a little bit maybe challenging at first. The general, and a lot of people miss this one. In general, let's just break down the words. Slow, That means kind of like tonic, slow, postural muscles, right? Oxidative, what does oxidative refer to? Oxidative. Where does oxidation take place in the cell? Where are we talking about that? Where does it need oxygen? Mitochondria. So already, mitochondria should fit here, right? You should be thinking mitochondria when you hear oxidative. Have more or less numbers of mitochondria than fast glycolytic. Glycolytic takes place where? Cytoplasm. Means without the mitochondria, right? These are the fast muscle fibers. So if which one would have more mitochondria? The fast or the slow muscle fibers? The slow. You can also think of those as red muscle fibers, right? Slow. So they're going to have a greater number of mitochondria than the fast glycolytic. Or if you stained for mitochondrial enzymes, we could just reword the question. If you stained for mitochondrial enzymes with an antibody, you would get a greater staining, you know, in those. If you, you know, look for a different type of stain, maybe more glycolytic than oxidative, fast muscle fibers. Okay, so try to just break it down. It might have been some testing anxieties too, but I tried not to just make you remember. I told you I didn't want you to just memorize the types and all those things, and there's really like five different categories. So I tried to help to make sure, in case you've learned that in other classes of type 1 or type 2, and but also oxidative and glycolytic. But just break those down a bit if you could. Cardiac muscle. It's interesting because we talked about cardiac muscle being different than skeletal muscle. Remember that table on the muscle? You have to kind of look over that table and smooth muscle. So the main differences of skeletal and cardiac, what's some of the main differences of cardiac and skeletal? Pardon? Yeah, both skeletal muscle and cardiac are multinucleated, right? Smooth muscle can be, depends on what we're talking about. But the other, some of the main things, cardiac muscle has what, electrical activity? So how does electrical activity travel from cell to cell to cell? Through gap junctions. And so that's a big factor. And they are also striated like skeletal muscle, but not all the cells are arranged in the same order, right? But you'll still see the striations. The other main factor is that where calcium comes from. Those are the main factors. Calcium in skeletal muscle in mammalians comes from sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? Depolarization down the T-tubule. What receptors does it conformational change occur on? Dihydropyridine receptor. Internally, that's connected with the ranitidine receptor. Conformational change pulls the plug out of the bathtub. Calcium dumps out. Calcium binds to troponin C. Remember I told you to walk around and pretend you're psychotic and talk to yourself while you're walking around campus and go through that scenario. Blank pieces of paper are really good to do this. And then cardiac muscle, the main factors are that calcium comes from not only the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but also across the plasma membrane. Now, where this can be a little confusing, invertebrates like Drosophila, crustaceans, your favorite preparation, the crayfish, calcium on skeletal muscle can come across the plasma membrane as well as the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So really, when you see those kind of standardized exams, don't get confused because they're referring to mammalian preparations, usually like on an MCAT or something. So this is why I try to make that point. It depends on the preparation you're talking about. So many invertebrates, for skeletal muscle, the calcium comes across the plasma membrane as well as the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But remember, maybe we covered it a little bit quickly. Why would it be maybe just the plasma membrane versus the sarcoplasmic reticulum? Where do we see sarcoplasmic reticulum developing in skeletal muscle if you looked across the animal kingdom? If you had a single muscle cell that's just one muscle fiber and not too many, you know, myofibrils inside, would you really need a sarcoplasmic reticulum? Because if you had calcium on the surface, you could just keep calcium in and it doesn't have much to diffuse through. That's like a Drosophila larval preparation, just a single muscle fiber. Really easy for calcium to diffuse. But when muscle starts to get bigger and bigger and more myofibrils inside, that contractile element's very big, right? The diffusion is too great to get to the inside of these cells. So this is where you see in the bigger muscles, you actually see more sarcoplasmic reticulum develop. structure, function, relationships, and physiology are just fantastic to look at on a comparative scale. This is a really good example of that. The bigger the muscles, more myofibrils inside, you'll see more sarcoplasmic reticulum in the inside because the diffusion is too great for calcium just to come through the plasma membrane. So in large muscles, mammalian muscles, calcium primarily in skeletal muscle, sarcoplasmic reticulum. In invertebrate preparations, calcium in skeletal muscle, plasma membrane, as well as can be sarcoplasmic reticulum, but in many cases it's just the plasma membrane. Crustacean, invertebrate skeletal muscle acts like your cardiac muscle in some aspects with the calcium. Okay, so that helps. So what's different about smooth muscle while we're on this? What types are the two different types of smooth muscle we wanted to remember? One that functions as a single unit, which means all the cells are connected somehow. By what kind of connection? Like your heart? Gap junctions, right. And then multi-unit, where they act individually, they don't have the gap junctions, right? But still inside, there's still myosin actin. It just doesn't have that nice striated appearance, right? So non-striated. Okay, so try to keep that in mind. That table that we went over with muscle, really good to look through that and get an idea. Remember, studying blank piece of paper is really the best way to rewrite things. Okay, we talked about the shaker muscle, and I gave you that nice video of the rattlesnake roundup, you know, trying to make you cement it into your brain. Right, the rattlesnake shaker muscle, or the boatfish, you know, sonic muscle. Why can it beat so fast? It has to relax and contract. Relax and contract. How does a muscle relax? It has to take the calcium back up. It has to drop that calcium down to have the troponin C not have the calcium so it can hide the active site so the myosin doesn't stay bound to it when it ratchets back and forth. And the only way this happens is by having a lot of sarcoplasmic reticulin pumps that can pump that calcium back up into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, so then the calcium will drop, so the heads can't attach, but can relax, so then it can contract again. So in fast muscle, really super fast muscle, like the boatfish and the shaker muscle, it can relax and contract because there's a ton of the pumps on the sarcoplasmic reticulum to pump that calcium back in really quickly to drop it down so the muscle can relax and then be stimulated again. So it's really quite neat, very high energy demanding process, which means B. Okay, acetylcholine esterase, I gave a lot of leeway on this, the best I could for people. And some of you just lost a half a point, and some, you know, the whole thing. Or some, I could understand where you were, but then others made some wrong statements that were in there too. But very quickly, and some of you got it right on, great. Acetylcholine esterase, acetylcholine is released from the vesicle, right? Goes across the synaptic cleft, binds to acetylcholine receptors. These acetylcholine receptors, just on their own, they bind acetylcholine like it's your skeletal muscle. What happens? It's a ligand ion channel. It's a nicotinic type of channel. Inotropic. It opens up, allows sodium to go in, some potassium to come out. But with acetylcholine still bound to it, it actually will open up for a bit, but it actually goes into an inactive state while acetylcholine is still bound. And when it goes into that inactive state, the affinity of the receptor decreases for acetylcholine, and it can come off, but it stays in that little inactive state for a bit, and then it gets back to a state again, like a voltage-gated sodium channel. So now let's rethink what happens. How does the acetylcholine, if it stayed around, what could happen? It could rebind, right? So the one aspect of the inactivation is that it won't be reactivated until the acetylcholine is away. It's kind of like the refractory period of the voltage-gated sodium channel, right? So what happens in that meantime to get acetylcholine away so you don't get the rebinding problem? You have acetylcholine esterase, and that acetylcholine esterase chops it up, and then choline gets popped back into the presynaptic nerve terminal by a transporter. Nerve gas agents, why this is important. You heard about nerve gas agents recently in the news. And multiple cases, like in Philippines, I think it was, or Malaysia, and also in England. And the aspect is, if it blocks it, and insecticides work this way. Many insecticides work this way. And people die every year. It's primarily children and farm workers die from insecticide poisoning because the insecticide blocks. Some of these insecticides are voltage-gated sodium channel blockers, but many of them are acetylcholine esterase inhibitors. And so it's important to kind of know this in general. So acetylcholine esterase, if it's inhibited, what's going to happen? You're going to get a lot of acetylcholine around. Now, I kind of gave you the points, but in the next time we have this test or this question, it won't be that easy in that sense. Is that acetylcholine is going to bind to those, but if it hangs around, what's it going to do to those receptors? Activate them, and then they all stay in a desensitized state. And then you do not have enhanced muscle contraction. You have relaxation because there's nothing stimulating the muscle. The receptors are in a desensitized state. So what happens is you would have to give atropine to displace the acetylcholine. That's the competitive antagonist for a nerve gas agent if you were exposed to it. To give you atropine to displace the acetylcholine. So then the receptors could be ready again so you could keep your breathing. But basically you're going to a ventilator and they ventilate for you until you kind of clear the agents away from you. Like the two people in England right now that are in the hospital with nerve gas agents that they've been exposed to. But most likely, your brain's all messed up too. But they want to keep you breathing. Now some of you went on to the heart, and that was okay because we talked about the heart that day. And I know that you have that in the lab. If you block acetylcholine esterase, then you would have more vagal nerve, right, stimulation on the heart, and then it might depress the heart longer. So that's okay because I didn't specify well on here about skeletal neuromuscular junction. It was broad, right? And so my fault for not being that definitive on that question, which is okay. So that's why when you mention it, slow down, the heart would have more slowing. But I'm not sure it really would because what could happen on those receptors? Desensitization also, right? So then it wouldn't be so responsive. So it's just kind of keep that in mind about these aspects. Many agonists, which act like the neurotransmitter, are many antagonists, which would block the normal endogenous compound. If they bind to the receptors, they will cause them to desensitize over time. And either an agonist or an antagonist can cause those receptors, if they're inactivated over time, can actually cause upregulation, upsynthesis, to try to make more of those receptors by the cell to try to compensate for that. So this is some of the issues that people have, like what we talked about with Botox, for example, right? People get the Botox injection, keep the wrinkles or the wrinkles in their forehead or whatever reason. The nerve's not releasing the transmitter. The target cells says, I'm not getting the transmitter. Your muscle's saying, I'm not getting it. So what happens? Retrograde signals go back to the nerve terminal and say, you're not giving me enough signal. And then that signals the nerve terminal to start branching. It's the homeostasis of synaptic transmission. There's this retrograde feedback, which is really cool. So it's the same kind of idea. If you're blocking those receptors and it says, I'm not getting the activity, I'm not getting the depolarization, I'm not getting enough information, make more receptors do something to get me back to the normal level. So this happens when people take medications too for long periods of time. You might hear about desensitization and they have to keep jacking up their medication, right? Some of these antipsychotics are this way, and they have to keep jacking it up because the receptors are changing in their expression levels. Are they desensitized? Are there too much activation? It might downregulate them, so you have to give more to get the same sensitivity. Neuropharmacology is a great course if you can take that, or just a pharmacology course sometime down the line. You learn a lot of physiology in a course like that, so really good to think about. Okay, so that's the acetylcholine esterase. The dark current, I know, Darth Vader, you know. All right, so dark current is due to what? It's when you don't have a visual signal going on your rods and cones, no light being stimulated on your rods and cones in the dark, so it's dark, right? It's not evil, it's dark. And then there's a constant current in the absence of light, and that constant current is due to what? Ion, primarily sodium, it's depolarized, right? That cyclic GMP, keeping this cell, keeping these voltage gated, these sodium channels, cyclic AMG mediated sodium channels open in the dark. When light shines, they close and the cell will hyperpolarize or go towards the E potassium instead of the E sodium. So the dark current is a depolarized state of the rods and cones due to the sodium current. That's all I really wanted on that one. And we got some interesting things. Any questions on the quiz? where do these quiz questions come from? Anybody recognize them? Straight out of the test bank, straight out of the old exams that are on the web page. I just cut and pasted, cut and pasted, cut and pasted. Every one of these is on your test bank. Every one of them. Okay, so I know there's a lot there, but the idea, you know, you got to keep up and keep looking through those. So what are you going to do this spring break? Take one day off on Saturday, and then start up again and start going through that test bank, because that's a good review for you. Go through the test bank, look at those questions. If you happen to have the book, might be a good time to open it, start reading, keep up, right? And there's a lot of information coming down the line. Where are we going next with this? Endocrine. A lot of things to memorize. I hate the word memorize, but there's a lot to memorize. And then we get into cardio and vascular and then renal and osmoregulation. Woof, a lot. Oh, yeah. So I emailed everybody about how to do that on a Mac. So if you download the file, don't try to click it online because the server's bad. But if you download the file onto your computer, and you know that little, it's called VLC. I forgot what it stands for, but you can download this VLC. It's like a little construction cone, a yellow construction cone, and that one opens up those files. Anybody else have a Mac problem? The VLC, is it working for you? Just the podcast?
Yeah, it's just like the audio.
Okay. Oh, yeah, when we draw, it's not, that's all up here, right? So that's not being recorded. When we draw, it's the echo just gets whatever on the computer screen. All right?
I mean, it's also not a video, though. It's just pure audio.
Is it Mac?
Yeah.
That's
but
why.
With the VLC.
Oh, okay. So there is a way to get it to show on a Mac.
It's the same way with just like a regular PC right now, though, too, because I just have like an Asus laptop, and like there's no picture with it anymore. Now it's just like your audio.
Well, that's wild.
Yeah.
Let's see, what on earth is going on? Okay. I think it might depend on which day things were recorded, possibly. Oh, maybe this won't work because I'm actually recording from Echo at the same time. What's happening? Oh, it's downloading. These are gigantic files, right? 200 and something megabytes. They're really big files. So, hopefully with the podcast... And the PowerPoint, you can figure out a lot that's going on right there at the same time. And I, at least the echo's on this thing, and I know the podcast is on that little microphone, so if I go away from that microphone, it's an issue. But it should function. You can get the Beatles songs, though, right? That's most important. Sorry, I shouldn't joke. Priorities, exactly. Priorities, very important. All right, so that's downloading. So what we're going to do today is I'm just going to go back to wrapping up a few things on the sympathetic, parasympathetic system, and then we're going to start the endocrine, and then we have some fun drawing times just to make sure we're all working together. And spring break comes up, and you forget everything, and then we start back again. But we've got to review over spring break, right? We've got to review over spring break. And I know this is your only course that you have, right? This is the only course you have. I know. This is the mentality everybody has with you. So let's see what's happening here. This crazy file. So this one's opening. You see, we went through whatever we showed last time, the NSF webpage and things. So maybe some of them, and then I'm hearing it through my echo thing. So I don't know if it's been your computer, or maybe I think sometimes the Surface computers might not have the video or the right software on there. You might have to see it on a different computer. I know my Surface, I was planning to record echoes on my Surface, but the memory wasn't good enough, and it actually has a problem with some of the videos on my Surface. So it might be a Surface issue if you're using those. I just don't know exactly what some of those... Oh, look, I have to go up here. Okay, what some of those issues might be. Okay. But hopefully, trying to record everything. All right. So back up. Oops, we have to go back. Okay. Yes, in things that I draw up here are not recorded, but, you know, that's one benefit of coming to class, I guess. But at least I am keeping it on audio so you can hear it and hopefully imagine what's being drawn. So let's just think a little bit more. I know this is, you know, there's a lot on these tables, and you might assume it's just a little bit, but actually there's quite a bit to it. But related to your real life situation, if you have to give up and give a talk, which some people just hate to do for some reason, I don't know. Everybody have 425 by now, or 426, right? Was it that scary? You went into it maybe scary, right? But then after it was over, it wasn't so bad, right? Because it's your colleagues. How do you prepare to give talks? I know for some reason this is a big fear of people. But practice, right? Talk to yourself, record yourself, practice it back, and then the more confident you are, the less fearful you are. But try not to be nervous about talking in front of people, because it's so important to be able to talk science to people too, or go to schools and talk to the public.
What lecture are you on? Are you on eight?
This is the behavior one.
Seven,
something like that. Okay, so when you get nervous, what happens? All of a sudden, you can't talk. Like your mouth is all dry, right? Why is it dry? You know, dry mouth, right? Small amount of viscous saliva. When you want to eat a meal in your relaxed state, right? You got that bear steak up on the grill while you're in the hot tub with your significant other, right? With your glass of wine. Well, that's when you produce a lot of saliva. So the parasympathetic actions, right? And where you're going to digest a meal, relaxed state, right? So, I mean, just think about those. Across. And we're going to come back to some of these important aspects when we talk about endocrine, right, and the adrenal glands. So adrenal medulla stimulates secretion, epinephrine, norepinephrine being released, right? And what's that going to do to the heart? Speed it up, right? So that's going to relate to your increased heart rate as well. So you can think of it, it's correlative here. A lot of people miss questions on open response questions with the sympathetic and parasympathetic system, so try not to get too worked up about that. The other part is the bottom part, like we talked about, if you're going to run from that bear, right, that's going to attack you or something, you don't want blood vessels going to your skin and gut. You're not going to worry about it. That's why some people look pale when they get scared. They look like, oh, I've seen a ghost, you're pale, really, you know, scared, because your vasoconstrict, the skin blood vessels, and you lose the blood to your skin, you look super pale. So this is the skin and gut. You're not digesting, you know, at that time. So you decrease blood to your GI tract, but you could vasodilate some vessels, like your skeletal muscles, to get blood there to be able to run, get the oxygenation going, right? And that's important. Also, then you think about just kind of the other effect, is that it says no effect there, but after you eat a meal, you actually increase your blood flow to your GI system, right? It may not be so much under parasympathetic, but it's the lack of the sympathetic. This is where it gets a little confusing sometimes. If you don't have the sympathetic drive, then you can get more blood flow to the other tissues instead, if you're not vasodilating your blood vessels to your skeletal muscle. So like your mom said, you know, you don't go swimming after you've just eaten a meal, if you're out of the lake, right? Because why? You might get stomach cramps because your blood flow's not going to your stomach. You know, kind of these wise tales. Grandma's, mom's always right, right? All right, so kind of put these together a little bit. The top one with the lungs is really quite interesting, too. And if you get into pharmacology, a lot of medications do what? They work on the sympathetic and parasympathetic system, primarily a lot to dampen the sympathetic system or maybe work on particular receptors. Dilates bronchioles. Why would you want to dilate your bronchioles? More air, right? Get that oxygenation going. So really important to kind of pull all that together. All right, so this is important to think about. When you think about, too, some of the medications that are used, if somebody has an asthma attack, and we won't go through the different types of medications, but if you wanted to dilate the bronchioles, you might give a compound that would be like an agonist to the sympathetic receptors for that, right? And usually what happens with some of those people that might have COPD and they're getting some of their bronchodilators is that all of a sudden they feel anxious and nervous. Well, what are they stimulating? It's like stimulating the sympathetic system, and their heart rate picks up. And then they feel more anxious because the heart rate's going faster, too. But what's going to happen to blood pressure, too? It goes up, too. So you can get the whole idea. You can understand what's happening to that person as they're trying to just bronchodilate to maybe get rid of some breathing problems. So this is things that are kind of interesting when you pull it all together. Okay, so in the last part, these alpha-beta receptors we just talked a little bit about depends on the sympathetic system. These alpha-beta receptors, this really confused the literature for a long time. People were very confused in the earlier literature. You'd see people stimulating a sympathetic nerve, and some blood vessels were contracting, and then other ones were dilating. I'd say, well, this is confusing. This one's contracting, that one's dilating. And then they would put on, finally, different agonists or antagonists, and they would just stimulate the beta or the alpha, and then they started to separate out the subtypes of alpha and beta, like a beta 2 blocker. You've probably heard of beta blockers, right, for the heart. Different types of these receptor subtypes, and then it became clear there's really different ones that do different functions. So again, it goes back to the point about we made a long time ago. It's not the transmitter, it's the receptors, right, that make the difference. So just to kind of rehash on that, because that'll come back to haunt us later on. I will put up another series of slides on endocrine problems that are related to like human health. I think it's pretty cool. But they're a little bit, I just want to make that disclaimer right ahead that they're more in depth than what I would test you on. But what we cover when we do the endocrine problems, what I'm going to post that online, is just the kind of things that we hit in the class, the main points of what we're going to be responsible for. So I don't want you to get too freaked out by it. But I think this makes it a little bit more interesting if we think about endocrine problems with ourselves. The endocrine chapter or topic, doesn't matter which textbook you pick up, they're all going to be pretty much the same on the ideas of, you know, insulin regulation, calcium control, you know, glucose regulation, glucocorticoids, anterior and posterior pituitary, how all that works, right? The thyroid, all those are standardized type of endocrine organs that are going to be talked about. There's a little bit more in some of the textbooks on a comparative aspect. So we'll just hit a few of those aspects, but mostly the textbooks are pretty mammalian oriented. There's some really neat, and you know, sad in some cases too, problems with endocrine system in humans that relate to disease states. A friend that's over in second year med school right now, he came back and he said, Cooper, I remember you talked about this in 350, and they just mentioned it in our class, but our other classmates didn't hear about it. But, you know, he heard about it. And this is this just to kind of get you going on different things, and kind of relates to some problems we have in society, too. This is there's a hormone, right, a precursor to making testosterone and estrogen. Cholesterol is important. And so when everybody says, oh, don't have any cholesterol in your diets. Well, it's very important to have cholesterol. It actually, as we know, works on your bilipid membranes also. But it also is the precursor to many hormones, steroid hormones. It's a precursor to the androgen in estrogen hormones. So I don't want you to memorize this pathways or anything. But the take home here is that through cholesterol as the backbone, you can then make testosterone. And then the active form, dihydrotestosterone in the body. But also, with one enzyme, aromatase, you go over to the estradiols and estrogen being produced. So we see how important, and this is the very, you know, active compound for the female reproduction as well, as the male over here in dihydrotestosterone. Some people lack these enzymes. Are they not as efficient? And that can cause then developmental issues or phenotypic issues, but also sterility issues. So there is this group that lives in Dominican Republic that lacks this genetic mutation where a number of people in the population lack alpha 5-alpha reductase. So if they're not making this active form of testosterone, what happens, do you think, to the child that's developing? Big issue, right? Reproductive development and all that. So there's actually a nice little Wikipedia page on that. Where did I do this? Right here. And it actually was on BBC News. This extraordinary case of what they call here. These children grow up. They're actually males, but they grow up looking like females. The first surge of testosterone is not that high. And so they kind of the default is the female, because they are making estrogen, right? You can go through aromatase if you're not going through testosterone. And you make males do make some estrogen as well. So then they become more feminized. But about puberty, when they should be really jacking up with the testosterone and more of that pathway is being activated, but still not sufficient enough, they start to become male in the characteristics like facial hair and muscle starts to develop, and they wonder, hey, this isn't something weird's going on. And then they go get tested, and they find out they're really a male, but they weren't having the alpha reductase earlier. So what they actually do, because they've been raised like a female, many people in that society will then just go ahead and get the sex change and continue as a female. So, you know, this is kind of a controversial thing to think about in politics today, too. We won't talk about it too much, but some people have these issues and need changes, medical changes, for a reason. So this is a case, so you can put that on PBC and look this up. And so you could think about what these parents and what these children have to go through, too, but then being sterile for the rest of their life as well. So what they actually have done is just go in and actually try to do checks on people earlier on. They can use hormone therapy early on if they know that's a genetic defect and actually correct the problem early on. So a lot of interesting aspects with endocrine issues to think about that relate to today's society as well, our care that's needed for some of these people. You think about the other aspects, what about the pollutants in our society, right? We had a faculty member, Brent Palmer, he was here, he retired 2 years ago, I guess, and he worked on endocrine disruptors in the environment, and he did a lot of this work down in Florida. And he has this wonderful story of kind of the history of figuring out some of these problems. So they were at this meeting, and I think the meeting was in Hawaii or something. It was a reproductive endocrinology meeting. And this really opened the door for a lot of the problems. So they were talking about endocrine disruptors. One of the speakers at this meeting, I forget which year it is, was working on, and they were from Boston, they were working on breast cancer cells in the lab, you know, mammalian breast cancer cells. And they were culturing the breast cancer cells, and they were trying to understand these cells, and they would give estrogen, and then they would grow really well, because you have estrogen-dependent breast cancers. A long time ago, actually, a number of women had this problem. When they reach, you know, menopause, and you're a little bit older, what happens to your bones with a lot of times for older women? They have osteoporosis. And what is a common therapy for that? Fall back. It was estrogen, because your estrogen levels dropped. And so the estrogen would actually help with that. But what happened to many women at that point is they all of a sudden got breast cancer, because they were getting high estrogen levels. That was a problem. So what they actually found out, too, then if you did have breast cancer earlier on, before menopause and before you were maybe getting on estrogen therapy, to find out if you had breast cancer, was it estrogen dependent or not? And many of the cases, the earlier cases, weren't detected if they were estrogen dependent. So later in life, when they had osteoporosis and they got estrogen therapy, boom, cancer picked up. And it might have been metastasized, and a lot of people increased their cancer, estrogen-dependent cancers because of this. Big problem. So that was earlier on. Actually, my mom was one of those cases, actually. She survived this. She's 91 years old, going on 92. But she had an estrogen-dependent cancer. She was on estrogen therapy because she had osteoporosis, and boom, it hit her like that. And then, you know, we were out in West Texas at this time, and that little family doc didn't quite keep up with the literature, but we informed them of some cases, but didn't sue. You know, just tell them, hey, change this, because it's already been known that you shouldn't do this until you've checked this was estrogen-dependent cancer or not. So anyways, that was massive, because she had, like, massive, all the lymph nodes removed from her arms and her sides and, you know, mastectomy and all that kind of stuff. Really something else. So something to keep an eye on. Other aspects with this. So they're at this meeting. This lady's looking at estrogen-dependent cancers. But all of a sudden, her cells started to grow in the dish. And she couldn't understand it. They didn't add the estrogen yet. Why are the cells growing? Oh, maybe the students messed up. They contaminated the culture media. So do it all over again. Did it again. All the cells started to grow. How could this be happening? They didn't add the estrogen to it yet. And so they went back, and they found out there was only one variable that changed. The culture dishes from Dow Corning. They changed the culture dishes. They came out with a new culture dish. Fortunately, she had some older dishes in the lab. She just said, take all those cells, put them on the old culture dishes, see what happens. They didn't grow. So something about the culture dishes. So she asked Al Corning, what's different about these culture dishes? They wouldn't tell him anything about it. So she said, okay, I'm on this campus. Let's go over to the organic chemistry. See, organic chemistry is important. They ground up the plastic dishes, aliquoted out different, you know, levels of compounds that came out of the plastic dishes, and then tested them. And then they found there was an estrogen-dependent compound coming out of the plastic dishes. Whew. Interesting, right? So then back to Dow Corning, and finally they said, yeah, this could be an issue. Kind of thing. All right, so that's something. Then another group in Japan said, all these boys all of a sudden are becoming feminized. They're just at puberty, and they're developing breasts, and they're just, something's weird going on. So this group was reporting this, and they couldn't figure out where it was coming from. They tested the water and all different things. And finally, the Japanese group found out this is the time they were making those little noodle packages in plastic so the kids would take it to school for their lunch and just add hot water. And the estrogen came out. You know? And so a whole bunch of boys in Japan at this time became feminized because of these little noodle boxes that they had that were in plastic and they added the hot water to it. Then a group down in Florida was actually looking at the alligator. And the alligator population was crashing and still is kind of crashing. And they couldn't figure out why. So they started looking at all the alligators and say, why? You know, the females are there, the males are there, what's going on? But the females weren't getting fertilized. Then they started checking the male alligators, and they have a long lifespan before they become reproductive. Checking the males, they were sterile. Why were all these alligators sterile? So then they went and mapped out a whole bunch of things in the alligators in Florida and found out that closer they got to the plastic plant, there were more sterile male alligators. So the effluent from the plastic plant was causing the problem. So plastics, that's why you're told not to heat water in plastic containers, to really use your hot pots. Males, pay attention. You should be using like a steel pot, metal pot. And plastics leak that kind of estrogen-dependent compound. So now you can think about environmental pollutants, how what that can affect. Also, soybeans. Soybeans have what? Did you, anybody take botany and talk about different compounds? Anybody know about soybeans? It's a big crop in Kentucky as well. There is phytoestrogens. Phytoestrogens, plant estrogens, that can activate your estrogen receptors. Yes.
Wait, that was what I was kind of wondering as far as the mechanism. So they have estrogen-dependent.
Well, no, if you started injecting estrogen in a developing child, they will become more feminized. It's just that males don't make as much estrogen because it's converted to testosterone and dihydrotestosterone.
But the plastics don't have estrogen.
They have an estrogen-like compound. It acts like estrogen.
Oh, I see.
See, it acts like if you were injecting estrogen into you. And it's a steroid, so it goes right across your gut membrane, right? Because steroids are wild, aren't they? They go right through the bilipid membrane. So these steroids that are in your body, they're going through every cell in your body. Isn't that kind of cool to think about? It's like gamma radiation. You know, so they're going through all your cells. But wherever those receptors are, and when I was in school, all steroid receptors were where? What did we remember this from cell biology? It was always in the cytoplasm, and that they then worked on the nucleus to then cause gene regulation. And then they finally realized that many steroid receptors are also on the surface of the membrane, but that was missed for many years. Actually, it was actually people that were looking in blood vessels and actually seeing the first effect, but everybody would negate that and then only look at the long-term effect. And then finally somebody said, well, wait, if we do our control experiments, we don't get the same response. And then they actually figured out there were receptors on the cell surface that had an immediate response, but the long-term gene regulation was from internal receptors. So many cells actually have receptors on the cell surface for steroid binding. So I think it's pretty interesting with endocrine, right? There's a lot of interest that's in there. I don't get into that right now, but what we should do is have some fun. This is some fun. Fun. For a few minutes. Because we want to make sure everybody knows this. And we need to have some fun. So let's do some fun. Let's get together. What are we going to draw? Let's draw something. All right. What's one concept that you're really having difficulty with in here? You might have together, maybe even up here, some of the great penmanship. Right? So what kind of concept are you all having problems with? Synaptic transmission. Which one's the one out? Okay. What do you want to do? Want to do quantum analysis? Let's do how does synaptic transmission work at a neuromuscular junction? Just to get you down for this. Just to draw a synapse. And maybe some of you want to draw a skeletal muscle anatomy, right? The contractile elements of a skeletal muscle. You want to try that together? Thank you.